Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, GabFest fans, if you're a reader of Slate as well as a listener, you might have noticed that Slate.com recently installed a paywall. It's not a paywall for the podcasts, but it is for the print side. We wanted to let you know that with a Slate Plus membership, not only do you get great Slate podcasts without any ad interruptions, but you also get access to all the great writing on the Slate.com website. From recent coverage of the coronavirus to Who Counts, an ongoing investigation into whose voices will be left out of the 2020 election, Slate is committed to keeping you informed about everything this year has in store. And your support is extremely valuable. It helps Slate continue this important work. You can sign up for Slate Plus now at slate.com/gabfestplus. And thanks. And if you're already a member, just log in at slate.com/login. Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for April 9th, 2020, the It's Easy to Talk About Lysol edition. I'm David Plotz. I'm in Washington, D.C. John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes is in his home in New York City. Hello, John Dickerson.
Hello, David.
And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and of Yale University Law School, shuttered Yale University Law School, is in her home in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Emily.
Hello, hello. Yeah, law school has moved to Zoom. It is not shuttered.
I guess I didn't literally mean it.
It's physically shuttered.
On today's GabFest, we will visit again with Dr. Amos Adalja, the doctor and epidemic expert who talked to us a few weeks ago. How are we doing with COVID-19 compared to where he thought we'd be when we talked to him a few weeks ago? Then, Inspectors General, President Trump's extraordinary, dangerous, and dictatorial attacks on inspectors general, plus a big fight about the exit of Bernie Sanders from the presidential race. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. Dr. Amos Adalja is a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins University's Center for Health Security. He focuses on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, biosecurity, and he's based in Pittsburgh. We spoke to Dr. Adalja 3 weeks ago, as the worst of this pandemic began, or as it seemed to be starting to accelerate. So, Dr. Adalja, when we spoke to you 3 weeks ago, you told us to really watch out for hospitalizations, in particular, and the strain on hospitals. As you look over the past 3 weeks, and as you try to look ahead, how, broadly speaking, would you assess where we are? There are obviously thousands dead, multiple thousands and thousands upon thousands sickened, society shut down. But are we heading in the right direction as far as you see?
I do think we are heading in the right direction, because when I spoke to you last, I knew that there was going to be this mountain of cases that we were going to have, that this was not a containable virus. And I expected us to get sort of to the place that we are now because of the undetected spread that had been going on and what this virus represented. I do think we're in a better place now, even though you're seeing death counts rise, because we knew this was inevitable. But it seems to be that even in our hardest hit areas like New York City, the hospitals were able to increase capacity to a point where they didn't go into complete crisis mode, where they were rationing care. And we seem to have hit either a plateau or a peak in New York City. And I think that's that's kind of the weakest link in our system's pandemic preparedness, because New York City has unique characteristics in terms of its population density, its hospitals kind of always being almost at stress levels on a day-to-day basis, and the fact that it got hit early before resources weren't in place. So I think the fact that New York was able to survive gives me a sigh of relief. And I do think we have tough days ahead of us in places like New Orleans and Detroit and Chicago. But the fact that New York was able to cope with this is really something that shows that we have the capacity to do this if we actually work hard to make sure that resources are met.
How do you feel about the next step? So if we succeed in flattening the curve and keeping the numbers down, then we'll have presumably created a space in which we could have mass testing, we could have contact tracing, we could take the steps that other countries, particularly in Asia, have successfully used to be able to eventually reduce physical distancing. But there's a huge mobilization and ramping up involved in those efforts. Do you think that the federal government is effectively getting millions and millions of tests online, has started to think about the infrastructure we need for contact tracing and also for isolation?
So I do think that we've bought ourselves some time with social distancing. And now that there is this place where we can move to another phase where you start to see economic restrictions being lifted and some reanimation of the economy. Still, the primary thing will be not to have hospitals exceed capacity. In order to do that, we know there are going to be cases that are going to occur once you start to reanimate the economy, but you want them to be at a slower clip, one that doesn't put hospitals into panic or crisis. And in order to do that, we have to be able to identify cases rapidly, even mild cases, isolate them, do contact tracing, and kind of go back to what we should have done way back in January. And that's going to require a lot of testing. You want these tests to be as ubiquitous as an HIV test, that people can do these very easily, quickly at the point of care. And there are test kits like that that have been developed and that have gotten emergency use authorization by the FDA. Now, the question will be, can you scale them and put them everywhere that they need to be? That the federal government and the state governments are going to have to work aggressively to do that. And at the other hand, we have to make sure that our health departments are adequately resourced to do the contact tracing. So that's going to involve a lot of manpower and making sure that they have the money to hire those people. And maybe they can actually repurpose people that are not working right now to do contact tracing. I know in the Pittsburgh area, there are medical students that are helping the health department do contact tracing. There are ways to find other people that can learn how to do contact tracing so that we can augment the workforce, because you do need a lot of people to do contact tracing in order for it to be effective. And you don't want things to slip through the cracks. But this is going to be a major challenge, but I think that's where we're going next in this phase of the pandemic response.
Amish, in terms of what the public knows, there is sometimes a feeling that as a Catholic, the cafeteria Catholic picks which portion of the catechism they want to believe in and then orders their life that way. With social distancing, with a lot of these public health rules, people seem to be picking and choosing, or then sometimes overpicking one thing they hear. I heard from the White House, for the first time I'd heard it anyway, yesterday, about a 15-minute rule. So stay 6 feet away, but then something about, you know, if you're not in the presence of somebody for more than 15 minutes, it was a new piece of information that seemed to be being put out as public health. What is durable and what do we really know that we should operationally behave on in our daily lives?
Well, we're in the middle of a pandemic with an emerging infectious disease, and there's lots of pieces of public health guidance that are going to not be known about, that's going to change. What Dr. Birx said is actually correct. We don't get transmission of this from person to person without usually some amount of contact for a period of time. It's not as if you walk by somebody on a trail in the woods and all of a sudden you've been exposed. No, what we define as an exposure is, you know, closer contact that is for a duration of time. It's not some fleeting contact. So what she said there is correct. And it's been in the guidance. It's just not something that probably people ask her before, because we do that when we look at healthcare worker exposures to see who truly was exposed. But it can be very daunting for someone in the public to keep track of all of these things, because they do change. You may have different guidance different guidance from certain state health departments versus the CDC. There is some room for variation in how you implement the principles of public health when it comes to this outbreak.
What is the most encouraging thing you've seen in the research, treatment, and public behavior? Similarly, what's the most discouraging thing that you've learned about the disease or about our behavior?
I would say that what heartens me is the fact that hospitals have been able to meet the capacity. And it might sound paradoxical for me to say that when we're seeing record numbers of deaths in New York City. But the fact is that we knew this was coming and we've been able to avoid the Italy situation. And I think that's heartening, because that was really what was premising many of the actions that were being taken. Many of the economic shutdowns were to avoid the Italian situation. And when you have a healthcare system move very quickly with assistance from federal and state governments to meet capacity, to get ventilators to where they need to go to be able to augment healthcare workforce in a place like New York City, I think that tells you can do it mostly anywhere, because that's really where you're going to be hardest hit. And the fact that we've hit a plateau phase is really heartening to me. What I think is bad about this is the fact that this has become politicized on all sides of this. And I'm somebody who goes on all three of the major news networks frequently. And I've just noticed that all three of them have an issue, and it sometimes makes it much harder to actually get good information out because you get slanted questions from all three and you have a soundbite to answer. And there's a lot more nuance to this. So I do think that we expected this pandemic to become politicized by everybody, especially in an election year. And I think that's made it much worse, because you've got certain decisions being made and then people second guessing them to wonder if there's a political motive behind them. And you've gotten people going back into their tribes. And I think that makes it much harder to work in a pandemic environment. You know, there's science and there's medicine, and that's kind of not partisan, and it's the truth. So anybody trying to score political points over this has made it much harder for all of us to do our work. It's created conspiracy theories. It's created lots of cascading negative effects that we have to waste our time kind of battling back. And I think that's made it much harder, definitely more difficult than getting the message out was during Ebola, for example.
Have you been following the conversation around the possibility that low dose exposure could lead to less serious, milder forms of COVID? And is that another hopeful possibility? Because it suggests that people who have brief exposures might get less sick, and then that could help us build herd immunity faster.
So I would say in general, there is a dose response relationship, meaning the more you're infected with, the more likely you are to have severe symptoms. It's unclear to me, though, that people who get low exposures are always going to get mild illness. So I think there's a little bit more to it than just that. And I don't think that having a low dose exposure is something that people should in and of itself desire or try to use as herd immunity. We're going to get to herd immunity just because this virus is contagious enough that mostly everybody's going to get it over time. The low dose versus high dose thing really only matters more in the high dose exposure. And we're trying to explain why do sometimes healthcare workers get more severely ill, and it might be because of their dose, which is true with many infectious diseases.
Help people sort then, I guess, if the idea is that it's more than just temporary exposure, are people wrong to be, you know, wiping down their packages that they're getting? And the reason I ask is that when people are in that state of wiping down everything that comes in, it adds to that level of anxiety that then puts pressure on the politicians to make decisions about getting people back to normal or their tolerance for doing the things that actually might be more beneficial from a public health perspective.
Yeah, so I get lots of questions about, can you get this from this? Can you get this from that? And sometimes they can get very, very, very silly. Like when the UPS guy asks you to sign for something, how are you going to do that? Because you have to use his electronic pen. So you get these types of things, it's not like the virus is thinking, you know, I'm going to exploit these really odd ways of getting it to get around. I do think that people get very hung up on this because they're scared. They don't know. There's shifting information. You know, I'm not somebody that wipes down my packages. I don't think that that's a major, major risk. But obviously if I saw a little kid walk by my package and sneezed on it before I picked it up, I probably would. I think this is something that we have to all think about. We all have to be proactive about preventing from spreading any further. Really worry about the big things like mass gatherings or certain congregations that may get you ill. And it's going to be important as we start to reanimate the economy that people actually understand how to right size their own risk avoidance. And obviously for people who have other medical conditions or older who are at risk for severe infections, they're going to have to be much more meticulous about this, but other people are going to have to start to be able to think about how to incorporate avoidance of coronavirus into their life.
I have to say, I find some of that confusing. Like, I absolutely would have not taken the electronic pen from the UPS delivery guy. In fact, he hasn't offered it to me in weeks. I am someone who's desperate to right-size my risk avoidance strategies because I hate all of this, but I feel confused about what I'm supposed to be doing. And part of the reason I feel that way is not for myself. It's the idea that I could expose someone who is much more compromised and vulnerable than I am.
I think it still goes back to the basics of washing your hands and not touching your face. And I think if you're going to take the pen from the UPS person, the delivery person, just wash your hands. I think there's a lot of common sense that people aren't thinking about. And I think people have real questions about it. And I don't think that there is not like black and white here. There's a lot of gray, and you have to look at these risks in your own your own life and decide what the best ways are to avoid it and what's becoming, you know, too much or what's becoming compulsive and what's actually evidence-based and warranted. And I think, you know, maybe I'm a little bit skewed because I'm in the hospital all the time and I'm thinking that's my biggest exposure. I'm around patients that actually have this. So when somebody tells me, you know, can I take a pen from somebody else? I actually find that silly because I'm in a room with a person that's coughing with coronavirus. So my risk perception is probably I have a very high threshold to worry about something versus the general public. And it may be my own bias that's coming out when I kind of laugh off some of these. But and I think that everybody's going to come to a different place with this as we learn to live with it, because it's not going to go anywhere. Even when the social distancing ends, this virus is still going to be here. And we're going to have to think about social distancing in our own lives for some time until the vaccine is available.
Dr. Amos Adalja, thanks for coming back, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Anytime.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. Today, it will be a create your own. We will tell a story in Slate Plus if we can manage to get a story together. Not sure that's feeling like the right vibe right now, but whatever. We'll do it. Inspectors General, they are in the news this week because President Trump has decided that the Inspector General is his latest avenue of assault on government, on good government. So Michael Atkinson, the intelligence community Inspector General, who surfaced the whistleblower complaint that led to President Trump's impeachment, was removed in the dead of night at the end of last week. Glenn Fine, the Pentagon Inspector General, who was about to become the chairman of the new Pandemic Responsibility Accountability Committee, the group that was going to police how the government spends the $2.2 trillion it just allocated for corona relief, was removed from his job as the Pentagon Inspector General and now cannot become chair of that committee. The president also attacked the HHS Inspector General, Christy Grimm, on Twitter because she had criticized the shortages of tests and of PPE during the course of the epidemic, and President Trump took that affront personally. Emily, so what are inspectors general? Who are inspectors general, and why is President Trump exercised about them right now? And I probably left out some inspectors general in there, by the way.
You did leave one part out, but we'll get to that. Inspectors general are this vital part of the federal government who are independent within the various agencies, and their job is to investigate waste, fraud, and abuse. So they're the people who have the power to say, wait, 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 that contract is going to some crony of the EPA secretary, or wait, 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 I went in and talked to a whole bunch of hospitals, and they say that they're not getting the help they need from the federal government. This program is not unrolling the way it was supposed to. Or the EPA is not informing local communities of an increase in toxins that they have a legal right to know about. And so they're really important people if you care about the government functioning properly. They're the internal watchdogs in each agency, and that makes them the perfect target for President Trump. He does not want independent people within the federal government looking over his shoulder and in any way being able to gainsay his political appointees. And so that's what you're seeing this week. In the shadow of coronavirus, which has us all distracted for good reason, Trump is using his power to eliminate inspectors general who have shown real independence and pushed back against him. He's sending a message to all the IGs, watch out, if you do your job aggressively, I'm going to come for you. And he's making it safer for his administration to operate with minimal oversight.
I mean, Emily, let's be real here. Who can be independent in the federal government? There's one president. The president has to be responsible for everything that happens in the federal government. And how can there be people who are undermining what the president wants to do? Surely the president has total authority over personnel within the federal government, Emily. That's the theory of the unitary executive.
Well, funny you should... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, John.
I just want to note for a moment that goofy voice that you just embraced. But before Emily answers that question, can I just turn it just to, because David mentioned personnel, which is one challenge But there's also just operationally, under a more traditional administration, there is a tension between instances in which you want to move quickly and get things done and the proper oversight process, which, you know, wants to make sure that efficiency doesn't become an excuse for abuse. Even people who believe in the federal government in their bones recognize the tension between speed of action and oversight. But that legitimate tension shouldn't be mistaken for what's going on now.
The thing about the IGs, though, John, is they have nothing to do with speed of action. They come in usually after the fact, right? And so,
but that's the point.
Yeah. So it's
no
right, and they're part of how the executive branch functions. But I mean, one reason that your irony, David, is well taken is that yet another thing that President Trump did this week was to nominate Brian Miller, a former White House counsel official, to the job of being the IG with the specific role of overseeing all the money that's going to flow out of Treasury. So this is separate from that Pandemic Accountability Committee you talked about earlier. This is a person, a role that Congress, the Democrats, fought really hard for because they didn't like the idea that Mnuchin, our Secretary of Treasury, was just going to send all this money out the door to businesses with no idea of, like, who those businesses were, right? The original legislation said we wouldn't even know for 6 months which businesses received the funds. Okay. So the Democrats...
Well, can I just interrupt there for a second, Emily? I just think it's great that we now have an official who's going to make sure that those funds go to companies connected to President Trump.
We've
guaranteed it.
Two problems. One is that Brian Miller is himself a Trump political person. He comes from this job in the White House counsel's office where part of what he was doing was thwarting access to documents relating to the Mueller investigation. You know, he was the person responding to Michael Horowitz, the Justice Department IG, and he was blocking access. And he also has, in speeches, embraced the unitary executive theory that you were ironically giving us earlier, which is basically like the president has all the power and Congress isn't supposed to question that. And we can't have inspectors general who answer to Congress rather than to the president. And in that vein, and also in his resume, Miller looks a lot like Bill Barr, someone who seems like a kind of mainstream, if Republican, official who came up through normal channels in the Justice Department, but who embraces this, what used to be a very fringe, unshared theory that really puts so much power with the president that Congress can't see inside the executive branch. And on top of all of that, President Trump, when he signed the $2 trillion relief bill, issued a signing statement saying that he thinks he gets to decide which documents Congress gets to see through the inspector general, who is now nominated to be Brian Miller, though the one thing Congress has left, the Senate does have to confirm Miller's appointment.
A Republican majority Senate. John, one of the things that we've come to realize so much during the Trump administration, which you are deeply familiar with, is how much of what we think of as being the rule of law or good government is actually just norms of how presidents and Congress have behaved and courts have behaved. What do you think the remedies are when you have a president who's so willing to extend executive power in the way that President Trump is and is backed by a whole movement of people who are willing to extend it, at least as long as Republicans are in power, and a court system and a set of judges who are willing to allow them to do it, and a Congress which essentially has been defanged? What remedies do we have,
well,
given that?
I think there are no, I mean, under that scenario, there are no remedies because people in the people who have power make the rules. I do think it's important to go back to my previous point by way of getting to a remedy to recognize the distinction between what the Trump administration is doing, both specifically now, but also what they're doing specifically now comes in a context, which is, and the context that it comes in is essentially any of these rules, regulations, laws, norms. And by the way, the president has shown, based on what we know from his previous cabinet secretaries and also from his behavior with respect to Ukraine, he has shown a disinclination, disinterest, and sometimes outright dislike of actual laws, forgetting norms for the moment. So that's what the president is doing, and that is outside even of this existing tension. And I think it's important to understand the existing tension, because what you don't want is somebody defending what the president's doing, which requires a whole new classification of defense and is much harder to defend. You don't want people giving a defense of what the president's doing, using what is a legitimate area of conflict, which is IGs oversee all laws, regulations, policies within a department. So they, what happens is it's not only what they actually investigate for the purposes of criminal wrongdoing. They also engage in constant ongoing kind of teeth cleaning of an organization that is kind of looking over the shoulder of the people doing the work. And then, and that has both possible tensions in what they're actually doing. And then it also sets up habits of behavior, which in the best of all worlds represent the perfect habits of behavior that's in concert with both efficiency and laws, regulations, and so forth, but is often in conflict. All that stuff is normal and natural. And I think people in both administrations who would like to make agencies more efficient often say that the IG process is a little too overbearing. Maybe not even because of the original IG, but because so many of these agencies are clotted with red tape and different regulations. So that's the existing thing. And that needs to be monitored and cleaned up and fixed just for its own, regardless of what administration or what party you're in. But to get to the actual president is to not make the mistake of thinking he's just being more efficient. You know, and this is a businessman cutting through the red tape. That's not what he's doing. And the reason this is so vital and important is that we've seen in the coronavirus case and in several others that if you don't follow the system of doing things, if you don't have your acting gear and stuff cleaned up and tight before the emergency hits, you can't figure it out in the moment. And that's true with corruption as well. You can't just like walk the cat back a lot of times because everybody has an interest in fuzzying up the past. So you need an IG to be on the case and watching so that people not only behave as good stewards and of U.S. money, taxpayer money, but also so that they do the right stuff in their jobs so that they, you know, reach the outcomes the entire agencies were created to bring about.
I mean, I guess I would say something else. Maybe I'm just so frustrated right now that we would even be thinking in normal governance terms. But part of what we're seeing is how Trump has moved the standard so far. So, you know, when he fired Jim Comey, that was a huge scandal. When he talked about firing his former attorney general, Jeff Sessions, that was a scandal. Now it's like barely a ripple that he's firing these career officials in the Justice Department who have this watchdog role. And, you know, look, like most people probably don't know that inspectors general exist, much less what they do. Plus any compound noun where you have the S on the first word is like a bad idea. It just sounds kind of stuffy. And the reason that they were able to operate effectively, and they have done so in growing numbers since Watergate, is that it just like you presidents were not going to fire the person who was supposed to be the watchdog, because that just seems so obviously self-interested and corrupt that it would get you into trouble with the whole government. Now we have a situation in which Democrats are outspoken in criticizing Trump on this front. We have barely heard a peep from Republicans. The one thing is Grassley talking about murmuring about how he wants a letter in which Trump gives reasons for firing Atkinson, who is the person involved in the whistleblower complaint. And I mean, that is just so little pushback. It's kind of unreal. And I guess the other thing I will just say about Atkinson is Atkinson's job in the statute was to forward a whistleblower complaint to Congress if it was of urgent concern. And it was credible. Once he made that determination, the word in the statute is shall. It's not may forward to Congress. It's shall. He was just doing his job. And so firing him, you have to buy into Trump's completely la-la-land narrative that, you know, his call to the Ukrainian president was perfect, that there was nothing wrong with the way he was operating. Like, you have to turn Atkinson into the bad guy in the story, which is just so far from reality. And the fact that there cannot be bipartisan, strong recognition of that, this is like why we are where we are. And then that, of course, is looking to the past. I mean, who even remembers things like impeachment and the Mueller investigation right now. But because of the pandemic and all of the spending that's going on and all of the terrible trouble hospitals and states are having in trying to deal with the federal government, it is very relevant going forward that we have these watchdogs, and they are being told to like stay on their leash as much as possible in this moment.
Two other points to follow on that, Emily. One is we have to recognize the scale of the money that's being spent. So we're talking about $2 trillion that is being spent, and the possibility of corruption, of misbehavior, of mismanagement is extraordinary. We've already seen with the SBA loan program, the $349 billion that's supposed to go out to help small businesses, an extraordinary amount of mismanagement already and incompetence that, you know, needs to be investigated, needs to be understood. And the Trump administration's willingness to countenance, to allow, encourage corruption, self-dealing, dealing to cronies is extraordinary. And it's going to end up that there's going to be billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars that are siphoned off, that are delivered to people who have friends in this administration or friends among powerful people in Congress. And we may never know about it, or if we do know about it, nothing is going to happen to those people. And it's just dispiriting. And it's obviously, it's not as important as getting the health of the country right and getting the economy right. But a corrupt nation is a weaker nation. And this is encouraging corruption. That's one point. Just one second point, John. Let me just make one other point, which is I mentioned a few weeks ago on the show that I thought one of the things that was going to happen during this crisis is that the Trump administration was going to sneak through a whole bunch of stuff while we weren't looking. And that the cashiering of Michael Atkinson was slightly noticed. We're talking about it on the show. But that's an example of, like, let's just do it at the dead of night on, you know, at the end of a day on a Friday. They snuck through a repeal of Obama era fuel economy standards without anyone really noticing, without it making a news in the paper, even though it's going to cause unfathomable amount of new CO2 to be dumped into the atmosphere. So they are going to sneak stuff by us, even as this country is in the midst of the greatest crisis that it's had in a century.
And one thing I would add to what you're saying, David, is first of all, I think the inspector general behavior and the treatment of them is a part of the lack of faith in and interest in the normal operations of government that actually will make it more difficult to use the government to solve those bigger problems that you talked about in the economy and in the aftermath of this. But there's another aspect of this that's not just corruption, which is has the negative effects, which is somebody gets in there and says, I want this solved quickly, and I know a guy, and the guy you know is the one you hire because it's now easier to do. And it's not because you're feathering his nest, though that might be the byproduct of this decision, but you're putting in charge of something someone who, you know, just stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. If it's easier to move without oversight to get your pals to weigh in on things, you're coming to it fresh and new, which is great. In some cases, you have new, fresh eyes. In other cases, you have no idea how it operates within the context of the federal government and coordinates with the other agencies. And you end up creating more problems than you solve, which then have to be covered up because the person's been brought in a political track, not a policy track. So it creates mayhem, even if you're not trying to feather someone's nest, even if you're just trying to do, let's say, the right thing more efficiently. If you don't follow the process, you end up causing mayhem.
Emily, take the last word on this.
You know, my deepest fear about this is that it reads to people like the government can't function. And whenever it's the government that becomes less legitimate, it's Democrats who suffer because Democrats want the government to work for them. It's important to realize that the frame for this is corruption, and it's specific to the Trump administration. It is the Trump administration throwing a wrench into the mechanisms that make government accountable to taxpayers. So I would just stop there, but I feel like we have to talk for a minute about what a disastrous mess the election in Wisconsin was this week, and also about the fact that Bernie Sanders has dropped out of the Democratic primary, making Joe Biden the presumptive nominee. John, I need your 1 or 2 minute analysis of the Democratic field and this shift.
Well, I mean, you know, on one hand, it was kind of inevitable. I mean, we are in a, we don't know what our election looks like. And to the extent that the message and signal beforehand was that Democratic voters, and particularly want a kind of return to normalcy rather than another revolution, we are in a moment now where, on the one hand, there's a strong impulse, I think, to a return to normalcy, obviously a return from to the pre-coronavirus era. But then also, I think there's a strong possibility that people will look at government and say, I want government to operate efficiently, particularly on these big issues that can only be addressed by the federal government. And the fact that Joe Biden has a very close advisor who gets the highest marks for the Ebola response, Ron Klain, is probably good news for Joe Biden. For the message of, we will be the people who know how to run a big organization to the extent you can in a federal government. There's that message. Then there is the Sanders message, which is all the inequities in the current American system will be exacerbated and are being exacerbated by what's happening right now with coronavirus. They're therefore potentially creating an even increased appetite for the message that Sanders had, which is a wholesale rethinking of the way America works. How does that wriggle out at the end of this? I don't know. So I guess that's what's on my mind. And when does that start? When does that conversation begin in earnest at a level that's not just hobbyists and obsessives? And I don't know the answer to that is.
My take on this, Emily, much more dreary, conventional take, is the purpose of the Sanders campaign at this point was to bring attention to a set of messages around inequality and the misshape of the American government and the American economic system. And the nature of the COVID crisis means it's impossible to bring attention to those issues in any meaningful way. This is not a time when Sanders campaigning and his issues are going to galvanize people, draw attention, be useful to the debate. There will be a time for that. It's unfortunate because it's such an important set of issues, but it's very difficult for him to actually do the thing that he is trying to do at this moment. And I think he thinks the more important thing is to, in the longer term, ensure the election of the Democratic nominee, who will be Joe Biden, which Sanders knew it was going to be Joe Biden. And therefore, the campaign, both as a practical matter, he was not going to get the nomination, and as a ideological and sort of psychosocial matter, was not useful anymore. He wasn't going to be able to do what he's trying to do. And so it made sense for him to pull out at this moment.
I completely disagree about his message not being important and not being the moment. I mean, I agree with you about the politics. Like, I think that in the end, Bernie Sanders acted like a loyal Democrat, right? He stayed in through Wisconsin to get his voters out into this election, in which there were lots of state and local elections at stake, including a Wisconsin state Supreme Court seat. And I just have to take a moment to say that seeing those lines of people standing outside to vote, trying to social distance, wearing masks, really taking serious risks with their health, they should never have been put in that position. And it was truly alarming to see how partisan this debate just about whether it was safe to vote became, with votes in both the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court dividing entirely along partisan lines about whether this election should go forward. That is all really alarming. But to go back to Sanders's message, I mean, this is a moment in which we are going to see this virus. It is already playing out in a way that is more harmful to low-income people, right? Like the fact we don't have healthcare. Sorry, I'm going in my rant before I let you interrupt me. Like the fact that we don't have good access to healthcare, any guarantee of free treatment, living wages, paid sick leave, the fact that so many essential workers are hourly low-wage workers in grocery stores, on delivery trucks, all of that. Like that is Sanders's bread and butter. And Biden's going to have to pick up on that if he's going to be a successful Democratic candidate.
But David's not saying that those aren't important issues. He's saying that as a matter of prioritization and ordering, you can't get it through.
I just totally don't buy that. I think that's completely wrong. I think you have to make that an important part of the conversation right now.
But his point is that you can try, but you don't have the willing ears to hear because people are trying to figure out what the hell to do with the fact that the bills are coming and they haven't been paid. And yes, there are larger inequities, but they're just trying to figure out their, like, what's happening at the end of their block.
Right.
It's not that the issues aren't important. They're, as we both said, more important than ever. It's just a question of whether you have the megaphone, the microphone, and the audience that's sufficiently large beyond hobbyists and obsessives to be able
to get
that message
through. I think it's a huge mistake for Biden as the candidate now not to be saying both of these things. Like, yes, he should talk about Ron Klain and how they would run the show better, but he also should have a vision about how he wants to change things so that we are insulated and protected and have social resilience from a phenomenon like this. And that is a progressive vision. There is absolutely a map for doing that. And I don't buy at all the idea that you can't have a vision right now.
Emily?
Nobody's saying you can't have a vision.
I'm disagreeing with the idea that it's not like a crucial message. I think, yes, Sanders was losing.
It's a crucial
message. Dropped out because he was losing. That makes sense.
It's an important message.
It is. In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like, people can't, this is not, you, politics is on hold. It's not, the issues are not absolutely important, and that they're not more important than ever. And then the as you say, like, the virus and the epidemic have highlighted these things even more starkly and more cruelly than before. It's simply that the, as a practical matter, the message cannot, people are not in a moment where they are able to receive it. They can't focus on it.
I totally disagree. I just think that is wrong. And you don't have any evidence for it. Like, when you think about how people are taking in and understanding this, what is the evidence that they can't see that there are these incredibly important background issues that are feeding into this crisis?
They are important background issues, but they're not important background issues which have to do with a person's presidential campaign and attempt to win delegates in a primary campaign. It is, that's, to, by all means, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, every single person in the Democratic Party should be crafting a response and being having a vision about this. But it's not fundamentally a political electoral vision that gets you delegates for a convention. It's something
else.
Running a presidential campaign at this point is a distraction, that because a presidential campaign is an attempt to gather people together and get people around, generally physically around something, which you can't even do. And so, like, focus on getting the message and getting those bills written so that in 2021 you get those things passed in Congress.
What I agree with you that the primary was played out. Fine. What I am deeply, deeply in disagreement about, and I feel like now you're trying to wiggle out of half of what you said before, is the idea that this progressive vision doesn't have a hugely prominent, a central place in American politics right now. It is absolutely what we should be talking about leading into November. And Biden needs to figure out how to incorporate that. And he is not doing as effective a job of that right now.
Separate point. Biden is vanished. I don't know what he's doing, and I agree that Biden's absence is a huge gap in the American political landscape. But
conflating the message and the messenger. Like, I agree with you that Bernie Sanders carrying the standard forward as a Democratic presidential candidate was not the right strategy.
That's what I'm talking about.
But that's not what you said.
A presidential campaign at this moment that is.
But it's not outside of politics. It's about moving to the next stage of the presidential campaign.
But I think we would all agree vegetables are healthy. But right now, it's really hard to get vegetables in New York. It doesn't mean that the vegetables aren't still healthy. I should be eating them every day. More important than ever if you're not getting exercise and not moving around. Super important. They're just not there. So that's the argument he's making. Now, you can dispute whether they're there or not. But he's not arguing about whether vegetables are good. Vegetables are good. The question is there the venue and the ability to get through, is that possible? I think the evidence for the clouded nature of the U.S. Market right now for media and understanding is people are just trying to get their head around exactly what's happening with, A, the health issue on coronavirus. Wear a mask, don't wear a mask. 6 feet, not 6 feet. 15 minutes or not. Because they're life and death, they really make people agitated. The agitation is carrying a lot of weight in people's heads. Plus, they're trying to figure out about their jobs. We got 6.6 million more people filing for unemployment claims this week. So if they can't get their heads around the things that are at their front doorstep barking at them, it seems less likely that a larger though very important, conversation about the systemic challenges is going to be able to punch through if those immediate terrifying challenge issues are having a tough time getting through.
Seriously, I'm just going to say one more thing. I truly, deeply do not understand why you are both separating these two things or who the people are who you are talking about. Yes, we are all trying to figure out about physical distancing and the ways in which our lives have been utterly disrupted. It is also true, and you were just citing this, we have another 6.6 million people on the jobless rolls. That takes us to 16.6 million for the last 3 weeks. Look at the lines of people waiting for food at the food banks, the people who are going to come out of this with medical bills, who don't know how their treatment is going to get paid for. Again, like, it's not, to me, there is nothing separate from that and the conversation in the progressive movement that Bernie Sanders has been a standard bearer for. It is the same conversation. And to miss the opportunity to talk about it that way, if the Democrats do that, that will be a huge, huge error.
What's your guidance for how you think somebody should get that conversation past the ones that people are having in their home now, that we're all having in our homes right now?
I just don't know, like, which homes you're talking about. I think people who are low income, who are insecure, who are worried about their future are trying to think about all of those things and will understand, like, it will be intuitive to a lot of them why these things all go together. Like, the idea that it's hard for them to understand that maybe they should have a government that cares about whether they have food, that does not seem like some difficult concept for people to grasp.
Okay, Emily, finish it, please.
It just seems like a misreading of important parts of the American electorate.
Sure, but I think making it seem like it's some moral failing of our ability to understand it is wrong. I think it's possible that people could be more worried about getting food on the table and where they're going to find the money to do it than some political debate, which is going to seem abstract, which already seems abstract even in good times. Like, it's not crazy to think that people who are of even more difficult situations, the people I've been talking to all week for this show, are even turning the news on because it so disgusts them. I mean, if you've got a mother on dialysis and your dad just died of COVID-19 and you've got a 16-year-old sister who can't go to school because there aren't enough laptops at the local school for people to distance learning, you're not talking about what's Joe Biden's progressive vision.
I do not accept the idea that you, like, that it's, that the whole world, first of all, I just find that we're having a conversation based on zero evidence about, like, one family that you're channeling, or like the people Eli talked to at a food bank yesterday who were like deeply concerned. For me, it has nothing to do with I don't care about Joe Biden. I don't care about the Democratic primaries. Like, I agree with you guys, that is over. I am talking about going forward, like where the country is going to go next. And the idea that people don't care about that right now, that is not reflected in my reporting.
The discussion is about Bernie Sanders ending a political campaign.
You are both separating politics. I mean, I think part of what we're arguing about is like what you each mean by politics. And I just don't accept it. Like, I just don't agree with it fundamentally. And I think it's actually like a really bad idea to kind of wall off politics as this like abstract thing that's only like cable news heads talking as opposed to something that's vital to the way people's lives unfold.
That neither of us did that.
That is totally how I'm hearing it.
Well, that's definitely how you're hearing it.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th. Only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
When you are hopefully having a drink at the end of day, or maybe at the beginning of the day these days, and you want to talk to somebody about something interesting, John Dickerson, what will you be chattering about?
Oh, I don't know if I'll be actually chattering about it, but just this week, John Prine, the musician, passed away, and it was a really hard thing as a fan of his work. And probably one of the greatest pleasures of my professional life was getting to spend a day with him for a piece that I did about a year ago. And an hour and a half of that day is on YouTube. So if you're a John Prine fan, we basically just strung together a lot of the in-between times and put it on YouTube. And it gives you a sense of who he was as a person, which if you liked his music is maybe something you'll be interested in now that he's gone.
Emily.
Oh, I just want to say it was so sad. And John, your relationship with him was such a lovely part of your professional life. It's I'm glad you did that tribute to him. I have a different kind of emotional register chatter, which is really outrage. The Cook County Jail in Chicago has become, according to one study, the biggest vector for coronavirus in the country, the place to which the most cases can be linked. There are somewhere around 240 detainees at the jail who have the virus, along with over 100 staff members. And I think at this point, 17 people are in the hospital. And what's horrifying about this is how predictable it was. I mean, there are pandemic outbreaks happening in other jails too. Rikers in New York has been a particular source of concern. When I was doing reporting in the last few weeks in Chicago, I was talking to a defense lawyer there, Catherine Crawford, and she was urgently trying to get her clients out of jail because they were reporting to her that they didn't have access to enough soap. For a while, there was no hand sanitizer. They said that the guards were not wearing masks and that, like, they, you know, didn't really see gloves around either. Just all of these things were missing. And when we called the jail to check these facts, they told us that all of them were false. And we're really adamant about that, that we would be reporting false facts if we reported what the detainees were telling us. Then at the end of last week, 12 corrections officers through their law firm issued a letter confirming all of these facts and saying that they were afraid for their own safety because the jail had not been taking these precautions. So I don't know what is going on at this jail exactly. Sheriff Tom Dart has continued to say that soap and hand sanitizer were available along with protective gear, but there was some terrible failing here, and I really hope that somebody gets to the bottom of it.
What in other countries with the epidemic, are there jails and prisons as much of a shit show as ours?
I mean, we have so many more people percentage-wise incarcerated, so that's part of the problem. Iran opened the doors and let a lot of people go, and there have also been, there was a protest, and I think some people broke out of prison in Brazil over coronavirus, too. So this has been a source of unrest elsewhere. I think American jails and prisons, just because there are so many people there, and remember, the people in jail are there before a trial. They are presumed innocent. And what was happening in Chicago that Catherine Crawford was dealing with, she had to individually go into court, often multiple times, to get people out of jail who are being held on bonds, often because of misdemeanor offenses. And the sort of the out of whack sense of that, that, you know, you would be holding people for nonviolent offenses they were accused of, not proved guilty of right now, is pretty breathtaking.
My chatter, two quick thing. One very quick one. First, the news came yesterday that Linda Tripp died at 70. And that was something that's so hard to stay on top of the news that isn't COVID news. But Linda Tripp was a huge figure in the Clinton sex scandal that preoccupied certainly me and John for a couple of years in the late 90s. And she was she's a really ambivalent figure, verging towards villainous. But she's, of course, the woman who taped Monica Lewinsky and Monica Lewinsky's account of the affair that she was having with President Clinton and then ultimately shared those tapes. I don't know. Nothing more to say. There's a wonderful interview with Tripp in Slow Burn season 2, where Leon Neyfakh interviewed Tripp. And it's quite riveting.
Did you see that Lewinsky, before Tripp died, sent out a very nice tweet saying, despite the past, I hope that you are okay? I thought that was pretty noticeable.
Huh. I did not see that.
Yeah.
They did not. They never spoke after 1998. They had not spoken in 22 years. The other quick chatter is just to draw attention to the Washington Post reporting about the racial disparities in COVID-19 deaths and illness, and to follow on points that we've hit on elsewhere kind of in this conversation. Just this is a disease that is really, really hitting the most vulnerable people in this country hardest. And we see this in the racial disparity of COVID-19 deaths. And the Post has reported this out. In Milwaukee County, African-Americans are 73% of the dead, but just 26% of the population. In Louisiana, 70% of the dead are African-Americans, although they are just 32% of the population. In Chicago, Black residents are dying at a rate 6 times higher than that of white residents. And this is, there's probably a ton of reasons for it, but COVID-19 patients seem to be susceptible to diseases which are diseases of poverty, which disproportionately affect African-Americans and African-Americans in cities. So diabetes and asthma being two of them. And it's unsettling and disturbing. And at least the CDC now seems to be starting to track this and paying attention to it. But it's a alarming
fact. I mean, I think you also, it's important to recognize the structural inequality of lack of access to healthcare over people's lives and the effect that that also has on their health and on them right now.
Because of that, they were already in a bad spot, which makes them more vulnerable. Those pictures in Florida of people lining up to try to get benefits were just awful.
I did not see those pictures lining up to get benefits. What was that?
I mean, it made Wisconsin look orderly. Just people, just a big mass of people, hundreds of them, to file applications for unemployment at the state office because the state website crashed.
Right. The county was making people come and fill out paper applications, and then everybody showed up at once. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're just standing, all on top of each other in line. I mean, some of them with masks and stuff, but to see people that close is additionally unsettling.
Listeners, you have sent us great chatters this week, as in past weeks. Please keep them coming to @SlateGabFest. And this week's comes from Rachel Johnston at @RachMJohnston. She points to a Minneapolis Star Tribune article about a game warden in Wisconsin who last week, after a boy ran away and ran off as in extremely cold weather out into a very remote, hard to access and difficult, treacherous, swampy area in Wisconsin, this young game warden who had amazing human tracking skills, just without anything but his own mind and his own intelligence, found this boy before something terrible happened to him. And it's a really riveting and touching story that made me cry. So, and it has a happy ending, unlike everything else these days. Check it out. If you enjoyed the GabFest, please subscribe. You will get new episodes the second they're published. That is our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is managing producer. And you should follow us on Twitter @SlateGabFest and tweet chatter to us there. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thank you for listening. We will talk to you next week. Stay safe and healthy. We wish you safety and health. Bye-bye. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? This confinement and this period has brought all sorts of old things new again. Old games brought out, board games, jigsaw puzzles. And one game that I used to love and used to play with my children in the car was, I guess it's called Tell Me a Story. I'm sure there are other versions of it. And the idea is we're just going to make up a story right now. For the next 5 minutes, we're just going to tell a story. So, Emily Bazelon, start us off. You got the first sentence. Two sentences, maybe.
What I have in my head right now is the story of Passover.
No, start it. No, okay. Start it. doesn't matter.
There was a king, and he was threatening the health of a whole lot of babies. And there were two midwives, and they decided that they were going to fly in the face of the orders of these kings. And a baby was born, and they hid the baby and pretended that...
Can't you tell a story? It's not Passover.
I didn't want to have to start. Starting is so hard.
That's fine, but go ahead.
Let me think of something completely
No, that's
different.
Fine. And then we go, one of us takes the next sentence.
Go ahead, okay. John, you're next. Okay.
But this king had one great strength and one punishing weakness. The punishing weakness was his vanity. There literally could not be a glass of water on a table that he did not seek his reflection in it. And that ultimately would be his undoing. But his great strength was that he was hit by completely unpredictable and deep bouts of charity.
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.